Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is September 8th, 2017, and this is episode 51. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. So we're basically getting into the start of season two, I guess. We just had a new speaker today, a new throne speech. We'll look at those in today's episode, as well as sort of check back in on how Vancouver's by-election's shaping up. But before we get into all that, I want to give a huge thanks to everyone, maybe the like 25 or so people who came out to our live show last week for our 50th episode. It was a lot of fun. We went way too late for both us and half the people there who left early, and the other half who I think wanted to leave earlier than like last call. But it was
a little too polite to leave.
Yeah, it was a good time. We were still having fun. So we'll definitely do it again, but we will stick to a timeline where we have time to drink after, not just through it.
Yeah, especially on a work night for most people.
Yeah, and 3 hours of content was a bit much. But that was great. So the other big announcement we have today, which is really why it maybe feels like season two start, is we both, literally just 2 minutes before we hit record, hit our $75 a month Patreon goal, which means now we have to make more content. And the even bigger news is we also have another $50 a month on top of that, because the University of Victoria School of Public Administration has become our first premier sponsor. This is a big shout out to friend of the show and repeat guest Professor Lindsay Teds for making this happen. So between all of that funding we have, we definitely have enough to cover our expenses, and we should actually start looking at maybe upgrading some of the equipment. So instead of having one little mic sitting here on my desk, we could have better quiet mics right in front of my face. I could actually learn how to edit podcasts instead of making it up. We don't know. If there are suggestions out there, things you want us to do or think we should be doing better, send them to us. I'll get going with that. Well, first up, betrayal in the House Coleman. Today was going to always be kind of an interesting day. It's the first day back in the legislature, and I actually learned listening to Shane Woodford's Inside BC Politics podcast out of Radio NL Kamloops, which props to them for putting out a politics podcast and making it available to the entire world. The reason we had a Friday sitting today and the budget is on Monday is because the BC Liberals passed a law way back when that following an election, within 3 months, there would have to be a budget update. And 3 months to the day is Sunday, so Monday is the latest because of the weekend that we're going to get a budget update. So the NDP, having had all the fracas with Christy Clark's sort of back and forth over the summer, once they finally became government, scheduled the first day of the legislative sitting today so they could get through the throne speech. So on Monday, we can get a budget update, which means content for next week. But so today was the first time in 16 years that we had an NDP government sitting in the legislature. And the question that we luckily haven't had to deal with for a couple months, because everyone kind of got bored out of it right after the initial sort of back and forth, was this, who's going to be the speaker? Because the numbers are so close. And it got a little bit less close when Christy Clark resigned. But then this morning, after the really boring procedural stuff, Liberal MLA Daryl Plekis's name was announced as the only person who stepped forward and, or more appropriately, hadn't withdrawn his name from the consideration. Plekis is an MLA from Abbotsford, and he was most famous in the last couple months for being the one on July 27th who, at the Liberal caucus retreat in Penticton, threatened to quit caucus if Christy Clark didn't stand down as leader, because he was kind of tired of the fake throne speech she gave and then her sort of sticking around and not being clear about why. And so he was like, I'm kind of done with all of this. And then it turns out that was kind of his last time he ever spoke to any of his caucus colleagues. There's a piece that just went up in the Vancouver Sun from Rob Shaw talking about how this morning came to happen. And basically Plekis annoyed the rest of his caucus, or pissed them off to all hell because Clark sort of showdown, so he didn't really feel like hanging around. I think a couple days after, at latest, that caucus showdown, Mike Farnworth, the house leader for the NDP, was on the phone with him asking for meetings, and I guess Andrew Weaver was as well. And they were both pitching this idea of him becoming speaker. And then over a dozen phone calls and meetings later, we get to today when Plekis is sort of, even like yesterday, telling Rich Coleman, the interim leader, yeah, I'll get around to taking my name out of consideration, you know, stand with the party, all of that. And then he didn't. And then he stopped sort of returning Rich Coleman's phone calls this morning, and suddenly he's Speaker of the House. This was met with thunderous applause from the NDP and government side of the House, and I think the Greens as well. The Liberal side of the House was dour, I think is a good word for it. There's reports that Coleman's order to his other Liberal MLAs before, once he sort of knew this was happening, was, we're not going to show him any respect or any... There was no applause. There was no, like, mention of Daryl Plekis in Rich Coleman's first speech. And as soon as, like, he went to a press conference after, Coleman went, like, apocalyptic. He started going off about how this is a betrayal. He lied to his caucus and the party. How could he do this? What a terrible human being. A couple of the Liberal hyper-partisans on Twitter were saying the same things. Someone, I guess, asked Rich Coleman about, oh, could he be recalled? Because BC has recall legislation where you can recall your MLA with enough signatures. I guess you have to wait until 18 months after an election. But Rich Coleman was not, like, putting that away. He's like, yeah, why not? Let his constituents come to grips with it. And so the whole thing comes off as a bit petty, or a lot petty.
Petty mixed with temper tantrum is probably the best way to describe it. And yeah, just giving him the silent treatment when he's acclaimed speaker is, yeah, unbelievably petty. It makes you wonder what they're going to do going forward. They can't really continue to give him the silent treatment. It's pretty hard to address everything to Mr. Speaker and not do that. But it's definitely sounds like the Liberals are pretty pissed off and more than tad partisan about the whole thing.
Well, so the first press release that Rich Coleman put out from the BC Liberal press office about this said he was being dismissed from caucus and the party was very disappointed. They then reissued that without that sort of he's been kicked from the party line. And for hours this morning, pundits were like, is he a BC Liberal still, or is he now independent MLA, Daryl Plekis? With the Speaker of the House, that position is nonpartisan, but they usually still hold a party membership and sitting, well, they don't sit in caucus meetings. So I remember when this legislature first sat after the election, all this talk about, oh, well, the NDP have to politicize the Speaker. Well, now we have the BC Liberals are the ones who had Steve Thompson resign as Speaker. And there was actually a good line from the clerk when he was talking about how Steve Thompson was tall of stature and short of tenure. So he resigned, and now they've basically called it a betrayal for a Liberal to become Speaker. I mean, to Rich Coleman's credit, Daryl Plekis himself had said a couple months ago it would be very dishonorable or very disrespectful for Plekis to become Speaker, and he even considered a Liberal becoming Speaker would be an outright manipulation of the democratic process.
Which is a tad hyperbolic, to say the least.
And I mean, that actually matches some of the language I saw JJ McCullough using on Twitter, but we'll leave JJ in his own little corner. So the whole kerfuffle this morning over the Speaker was way more exciting than it was expected to be. I kind of expected it to sort itself out no matter what. I just didn't sort of expect a fireball implosion within the BC Liberal caucus like that.
Yeah, it does not reflect well on the BC Liberals, how they manage this one. And even suggesting that someone should be kicked out of caucus for accepting a position such as the Speaker, which is, you know, generally one of those things that you not only need to have for the legislature to work, but it's generally considered to be a, you know, honorable position to hold. And like, it's just out of bounds of kind of normal political discourse to suggest that becoming a speaker is a betrayal and, you know, should be met with removal from caucus or recall. And, you know, Rich Coleman, he's interim leader. You know, interim leaders should not be kicking people out of caucus for all but, like, the most extreme, this is going to sink the party if we don't disavow him sort of thing.
So the party, the Liberal Party, has since confirmed that Daryl Plekis is still a card-carrying member. He's still technically in caucus, but Rich Coleman is sort of having the, we'll see. Maybe he needs to cool down and actually think long-term, because there's nothing good in this strategy for Rich Coleman. It just looks petty. It looks vindictive. It looks like the BC Liberals want to do nothing other than oppose. And he was actually quoted today saying, we're opposition now. All we have to do is oppose. It's not our job to present an alternate vision. Which, this is going to be a long couple months at this rate.
Yeah. Before today, I was thinking that, oh, you know, Rich Coleman, he hasn't gotten much press this summer at all. He's basically been invisible, you know. Yeah, we should probably hear a little more from him. And after today, I am not thinking that. He does not appear to be handling the interim leader position very well, fluctuating between not even registering as someone in politics and then swinging hard to going completely overboard and making a mess of things and making the party look bad. And maybe she could run Ambrose a call and get a few tips on it, because she did a good job and he clearly is not.
So my only interaction or personal knowledge of Daryl Plekis was when I presented to the health committee last year on religion and addictions recovery, and the presentation went fine and most of the health committee members were pretty receptive to what I had to say. But Daryl Plekis at one point wanted to bring up how he's seen a whole bunch of evidence that belief in a higher power is actually all kinds of incredibly powerful healing effects. And he thinks there's a fair amount of evidence that prayer would be helpful for people. And I kind of just passed that along to an atheist blog to sort of put it out there as sort of an amusing anecdote. He's from the Bible Belt of BC, so I kind of get that that would be his thing. But that always sort of flagged in my mind when his name came up. But you know what? Full props to him. This was the honorable thing to do. It's a good personal decision. He gets a $50,000 salary boost and probably now has better access for support for his constituents. For the Greens and NDP, this means the balance of power in legislature is now potentially to the point where 4 years isn't impossible, whereas in the other split, it might have been. There's now 41 New Democrats to 41 Liberals and 3 Greens, which means the Greens still hold the balance of power, but on confidence votes, the Greens will be siding with the NDP. So, and of course, the other two missing in that count are the Speaker and Christy Clark's empty seat. So even when Kelowna West is eventually filled with a new Liberal, because
it's Kelowna West,
they'll still not have the votes to take down the NDP Green number. So anything that Andrew Weaver agrees with John Horgan on, which is quite a lot. It's not everything, as we've seen, but it's quite a lot. They shouldn't have an issue with that.
Yeah, the question of this government's longevity is basically going to boil down to how happy can John Horgan keep Andrew Weaver?
All right, well, after all the fun with the Speaker this morning, they took a bit of a break and the media got to go crazy over that for a bit. And then at 2 p.m., they came back together and we had the first NDP throne speech, which I found didn't contain a lot of surprises. It was pretty much a rehash of the NDP platform. In fact, when I looked at the three major priorities, which were basically affordability, improving services, and creating a strong and sustainable economy in their press release version of it, and then I looked at what the NDP platform was, those are the same three sort of chapter headings. So they definitely just framed it like they would have if they'd won a majority. Only there were a couple cops to the Greens. They definitely threw in there creating the Innovation Commission, and they said this is a Green initiative, which almost suggests to me they might be like hoping it fails or not being too concerned if it fails, because then they'll be like, well, that was Andrew Weaver's fault. But otherwise, it's basically things they talked about in their platform or things they talked about in the Green agreement.
Yeah, overall, there wasn't much in the way of surprises on this one. couple of things from the platform that didn't actually make the throne speech. Fairies, they made a few commitments during the campaign about that. That didn't make it in there. As well as, they didn't really mention the battles around pipelines or Site C. So that's interesting, considering it was in the Green NDP agreement.
And they've already been doing things about that. They've been strategic about sort of entering into litigation on the pipelines and talking about what they can and can't do in a bit more what we can't do than what we can. And Site C, they've actually already referred it to the BC Utilities Commission. And this speech did reference a number of things they've already done in terms of like ending bridge tolls and raising the rates for people with disabilities. And there also wasn't really anything in there about LNG, but the NDP was never really that hot on LNG anyway. The things they did put right off the top, though, the first things they mentioned were sort of talking about the big crises facing BC, both the fires, and they sort of contrasted that with the opioid epidemic and talked about how we need fast responses to both of them. I wasn't sure at first, as the lieutenant governor was saying it, whether it was sort of appropriate to be comparing the two, but I guess they both do require government responses, so all right. They did talk about, right after that, a government-to-government partnership with First Nations, embracing UN DRIP and all of the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which have been all big talking points of John Horgan and the NDP recently. They also went right into big, clear, easy wins that just need to happen, the campaign finance reform, having a fixed election date moved to the fall, having proportional representation referendum by November 2018, they said, which they'd talked about putting it in with the municipal elections in 2018.
Which is on October 20th, so that's a bit of an odd little caveat they stuck in the end there.
I was wondering if it was just a, like, it'll be recounted, like a technicality. They didn't want to be, it's not like a throne speech is binding anyway, so it was weird. But they'll also do some lobbying restrictions, and so all of that will be, I guess, the first bills that we'll see next week. Again, more content for us. But aside from that, it seems like there's lots of sort of vague overarching things on housing affordability. There wasn't any specifics on a number of other files, like education was just, we're going to throw money at it to make sure we meet the Supreme Court ruling, essentially. And then a bunch of other things are sort of going to consultation, like even the big budget that'll come out in February will be consulted on, which, fine, that makes sense. But they're also the first term of a new government, so you kind of expect them to go with what they said they'd do.
Yeah, it was a little unclear on exactly what they're going to be doing in terms of how they're going to be implementing a lot of these. Like the housing, for example, they talked about how the government will deliver a comprehensive housing strategy, create homes for people, work with municipalities, cooperatives, private sector to increase the supply of rental, social, co-op, and owner purchase homes, but and then to curb speculation in the market. But, you know, what that actually means, and, you know, are they going to start stepping on the toes of the municipalities that trade their feet on building approvals and all of that stuff remains up in the air. And yeah, same thing with the Innovation Commission and supporting engineered wood products. What exactly that means is a little uncertain.
So we'll have lots more talk about government by the people, according to John Horgan. There was a lot of word sharing in there, and, you know, for a better BC. I guess this is the campaign continued, but with a little less urgency, since we're probably not going to a provincial election for a couple years now.
Moving on to segment two, the race is on. The Vancouver by-election is starting to shape up with Vision, the NPA, or Nonpartisan Association, as they're officially known, announcing their candidates. Those are kind of the two big parties in Vancouver's municipal politics. So Vision Vancouver announced that Diego Cardona, a 21-year-old Vancouverite, a former refugee from Colombia, came to Canada at age 9 and end up having to navigate BC's foster care system after his mother passed away when he was a teenager. So quite the personal story for him. Not a huge amount really known about him. He doesn't have a huge...
He's only 21, so he doesn't have like a long CV of, you know, involvement at a bunch of different levels. When I was 21, I only halfway through university. So, I mean, he has been involved with the Immigrant Services Society, BC, the Federation of BC Youth in Care Networks, and he's spoken for the Vancouver Foundation's Fresh Voices initiative. So he's sort of been the out in the public speaking up for young immigrants and things like that. That said, the Vancouver Courier profile of him kind of suggests he's kind of an unknown, and a few other places are still saying this is kind of like Vision's. He might be a good candidate in a couple years once he's got some references or, you know, experience and stuff, but right now he kind of looks like the fill-in candidate almost from Vision.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. On one hand, there is that personal narrative, which can be quite powerful. On the other hand, you know, the guy is 21, and, like, no, you know, we get a sense of where he is on stuff such as welcoming new immigrants and residents to the city, but outside of that, all the other stuff that municipal governments have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, it's kind of a bit of a blank slate, so who knows how that's going to shape up. You know, Vision is a fairly well-run political party in terms of the campaign machinery. So just from that alone, that he has a decent chance of succeeding. But at the same time, you know, I think a lot of people are getting pretty tired of Vision's handling of the city. And, you know, it's the sort of thing I could see there also being a bit of a pushback against. And this might be why they didn't put forward a more well-known or experienced candidate.
Take the loss on the by-election so that you can go, oh, we learned our lesson, renew us with a majority again next year.
Yeah, they figure that this is, you know, by-elections are one of those times where people like to send a message. And, you know, maybe we don't want to put a heavy hitter in there who will lose and then have that black mark against them when they want to run for a full term a year from now.
Well, and across the aisle, the NPA has nominated Hector Bremner to be their candidate. He, ironically for today, was a former aide to Rich Coleman in some of the BC Liberal offices, and he's worked in a few other ministries as well. So he's kind of deeply connected to that, which might not be the best thing to have on the resume today, but maybe by the time the by-election itself rolls around, people have forgotten this latest thing. He's run for the BC Liberals in New Westminster in 2013. He's also connected to a couple sort of right-wing strategy groups, communications groups. Beyond that, his sort of main focus has been talking about increasing housing supply, so standard free market approach to affordability, which seems like NPA standard fare.
Yeah, so the NPA is currently the party with the second most number of seats on council. And they're, you know, one of the big parties here. They've held the mayorship for a bunch of years, though not recently and not since Sam Sullivan was mayor. But you know, it's also a fairly well-known political brand here. So that's alone gives him decent odds, I think, of winning. Whether or not he kind of has the campaign ability and chops to win, it's a little hard to say. It's a by-election, so turnouts are always low, which, you know, means personalities aren't always the thing that really motivates people to get out, rather than a well-funded get out the vote effort. So it's going to be interesting on that. And
the NPA for me has recently suffered, like even the last couple elections, suffered the same problem as the BC Liberals have right now, which is, what are they actually for? We know they're against the other guys. The NPA is very, we're not Vision. All right, you're for lower housing taxes, lower property taxes. What kind of, sometimes they were against bike lanes. Now they've kind of given up on that as the public's mostly come around, except for the person we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Probably good.
And so,
but it would not be healthy for the city if anti-bike lanes was the thing that really, you know, got out the vote.
And so the NPA's whole, like, thing is, we'll be Vision light, or, like, Vision with slightly lower taxes, which that's a fine brand, but it's not exciting or anything. So I think maybe we're just waiting for some ideas to come out. And given that it's a by-election, might be a time to actually pitch some besides just, we should increase the supply of housing. How? What specific, like, there's lots of tools in the city's tool chest to do that. Does he want to reduce regulations, as you've talked about in the past? Does he want to open up an entire new section of town to be redeveloped? Does he want to convert mansions into multi-unit homes in Shaughnessy? Because I doubt that's on his platform.
Yeah, well, he might be able to get the UBC vote if he'd turn Point Grey into a bunch of apartment towers so students wouldn't have to commute from Coquitlam. But yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that the increased housing supply can mean, and, you know, not the least of which is get approvals under 3 years to get stuff approved from the time the developers submit the applications. Like, there's a lot of stuff there that can be improved upon, but what that means is still not entirely clear, and just how successful one person is going to be when Vision's still going to have a majority after it's the other thing.
So those are the two sort of main party candidates. We also have talked in the past about Judy Graves, who's running for One City on a general progressive platform of focusing on housing and affordability type issues. We've talked about Jean Swanson and played a bit of her announcement clip where she talked about things like a rent freeze and taxing the rich in the most Vancouver fashion. She picked up the endorsement from Cope. So she's still technically running as an independent, but Cope, who used to actually run the city for a couple different terms, hasn't had a very successful post-Vision kind of political career once most of their members got swallowed up. They kind of did pretty terribly in the last election. I think they made the smart choice in just finding someone who had some momentum and sort of latching onto her. But I almost also worry with sort of how the Cope brand is doing. Like, if you go to their website right now, it's probably the least attractive, the oldest, kind of needs an update and a refresher. And I almost wonder if, like, the Cope brand might drag Jean Swanson down more than her momentum was not necessarily going to guarantee her win, but get some attention.
Yeah. So Cope, for those of you who don't rigorously follow Vancouver politics, is the Coalition of Progressive Electors. We love our acronym party names here for some reason.
We used to have TEAM, but I don't remember what that one was for. But
so yeah, like you're saying, they're kind of been out of the running as a main contender for a couple cycles now and haven't done particularly well. Yeah, Jean Swanson's got a, you know, fair bit of name recognition and, you know, kind of really plays to that end of the spectrum pretty well, but don't think it would be a surprise to anyone to say that I'm not exactly thrilled with a lot of her platform. The rent freeze, you know, is basically the, you know, it's rent control, and like, the evidence is very clear that a stringent rent control is basically the worst way to run a city if you want broadly accessible, affordable housing. You get a lot of people who luck into it, and, you know, it's great for the people who get in at the start, and it's terrible for everyone else as the amount of housing, you know, dwindles because, you know, nobody can make any money actually supplying housing. So, yeah, that seems to be a fairly terrible idea. And then the other part is the free transit. And it's just, is that really where the problem with getting people on transit lies? It's a lot of times cheaper to get a bus pass than pay for a car, gas, and insurance and parking in Vancouver. And, you know, when I have to drive, it's usually because the bus or SkyTrain can't get me somewhere very conveniently. Not that the costing really is the main driver there. So, you know, if we're going to throw, I think it's $550 million is what TransLink takes in fares in a year. If we're going to throw that much money at it, maybe we should be expanding service instead.
My other question is, we still have Judy Graves and Jean Swanson sort of going after the same corner of the spectrum, the sort of left, far left bit. And they're also probably going to be competing somewhat with Pete Fry and the Greens on some issues. The Greens are starting to carve out their own constituency. And then there's Sensible Vancouver's candidate, who we'll get into in a second because we can't not talk about watermelon. But so you have this kind of like left-wing vote split, and well, Vision's candidate probably won't appeal to the people who want sort of a change to the left. Now you have to kind of decide, do you want to go with Gene Swanson, the more independent voice, or this new one city voice, which considering it's a brand new party is pretty much an independent voice since it doesn't have, just with a bit more organization around it. But given it's a by-election with a general turnout for municipal elections in what, 30% turnout ranges, maybe 40?
Yeah, we're talking about two people who are going to be splitting the left portion of 10% of the city.
If all the left shows up that usually vote in a municipal by-election, any of these candidates can win. That's true of any of them, but the point is there's just so few people turning up.
Yeah, we're talking like, what, 10, 15%, maybe 20% if turnout, and what's the left half of 15%? Like, it's just not a huge amount.
It's going to come down to who can bring out their supporters, so who can generate more excitement. And right now, I don't know who of those two has a better shot at attracting more excitement and sort of...
It's probably going to be Gene Swanson, I think. This is the name I hear around a lot more, which... And there seems to have a lot more momentum behind it. Oh, and I've seen a bunch of Gene Swanson banners. I haven't seen anything from Judy Dreyer's around the city.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for those, particularly as the campaign moves forward. Then we have Pete Fry, who we've mentioned before about from the Green Party, son of MP Haiti Fry. He's hoping to join the other Green councillor on Vancouver City Council, Adrian Carr, who has been your standard Green voice, sometimes going with Vision, sometimes going against them. I think we've talked about him in the past, so I think we can move on. There's finally a candidate for Sensible Vancouver. I saw in a couple places it listed as Sensible BC, but it's the like Vancouver branch of that. If you don't remember it, Sensible BC is Dana Larson's pro-pot BC political party that also ran the attempt to get a ballot initiative on marijuana legalization, and that failed. Their candidate was listed initially in one paper as Mary Jane Dunstan, which would be fantastic, but it's Mary Jean Dunstan, whose nickname is Watermelon. Because she's running for Sensible BC, she's the cannabis-friendly candidate, and so their sort of focus is on standing up for dispensaries, relaxing bylaws around them, focusing on testing the product for safety.
Is this really Vancouver's big problem, that it's not pot-friendly enough?
Well, they did bring in a number of dispensary bylaws in the last couple of years, so maybe there were too many of those and they should scrap them or something. I don't know if it's necessary, but I am totally in support of more fringe parties getting involved in the process. Dunstan, or Watermelon, is fairly, I guess, well known around the Rec Beach community. She also runs a licorice shop on Granville Island's Kids Market, and she actually talked about the cannabis issues because she's like, well, I work in the Kids Market, and right across the street is this brewery there. There's always adults lined up, so what's the problem with having marijuana shops right by kids' places too? It's an argument you can make, and I'll give her full props for that. She also talked about how on election day she'll be organizing carpools to go from dispensary to the polls. I don't know if there's a law that you have to be sober when you vote in BC or in Canada, but maybe they should be on the lookout for that. 2 years ago, that she told the Georgia Strait that she would run for mayor in 2023, which, because we've switched to 4-year cycles on municipal elections, means there won't be an election in 2023, and I don't know if she realized that at the time, so she'll be maybe running for mayor in 2022 or 2026. But that's Watermelon. She's the only candidate who's been on the cover of the Georgia Strait one time, talking about Rec Beach in a nude Photoshop, which is, again, more power to her. So I don't know where the nickname Watermelon came from, but she's definitely fully embraced it. You can find her on Twitter at WeedDiva, WEEDDIVA, or her website for her campaign is votewatermelon.ca. So she's fully on board with it. But that's basically her approach is, you know, Vancouver needs more fresh voices at City Hall. So it's not clear who of these candidates has the best chance. The Georgia Strait gave NPA's Hector Bremner a 3-2 odds of taking it, Pete Fry a 3-1, Judy Graves a 4-1, and Gene Swanson a 5-1, just because of maybe the one city backing is a little bit stronger. It's hard to say. And Vision Vancouver, the 7-1 almost long shot odds, except for Watermelon's 15-1 odds.
Yeah, I think it's fairly safe to say Watermelon's probably going to come in last place. But yeah, I think in terms of most likely, it's probably going to come down to either the NPA or Greens on this one.
Well, and then the other half of the by-election coming up is to refill the Vancouver School Board. And this is a bit more interesting of an election. It's a bigger one, but it's also a harder one to follow because a lot of the candidates are even more unknown. So the city council, we had a couple who people are like, I don't know who this guy is. That's cool. He's running for Vision. He's probably got lots great behind him. Whereas the school board has people who just no one's really heard of outside of their friends, I guess. So Vision's, we're running to fill 9 spots. How it was before the BC Liberals fired the entire school board was 4 Vision trustees, 4 NPA trustees, and a Green trustee who sort of held the balance of power. And there was some consternation because the Green initially sided with the NPA after sort of being more on the platform of Vision, but then it flipped back and forth with the acrimony of the school board. So Vision's running 5 candidates, so they're hoping for a majority, but not any more than that, because with the weird at-large election system we have here in Vancouver, you just pick off the 9 people you want to be on school board. And so if Vision runs 9 people, but you only like 5 of them, then they might be splitting the vote with themselves. It works out really weirdly. So Vision is running the minimal it can to take control. They have a lot of former councillors on there. They have Joy Alexander, who was elected in 2014. They have Ken Clement, who was elected in 2008 and 2011, but just missed being re-elected in 2014. They have Mike Lombardi, who was elected in 2008, 11, and 14, and was a former board chair. And they have Alan Wong, who's been a trustee since 1999 and has been elected for Vision every time. The only non-former trustee they have is Theodora Lam, who comes from being a board member at Van City and sort of doing other community organization stuff. So Vision's running on the very, these are the people you know, plus a new person. You can probably trust them. Or if you kind of think back and go, that school board was so acrimonious, I don't want any of those people. Vision's probably playing a dangerous game on that front. These candidates have each sort of done lots of work for the school board. Ken Clement, for example, was the first Aboriginal candidate elected in Vancouver. He helped steer through some landmark sexual orientation and gender identity policies for the board. Mike Lombardi was pretty prominent as chair right when it was fired. Alan Wong has chaired the Facilities and Planning Committee for a long time and gotten a lot of money to seismically upgrade schools in the city. So they have the experience, and if you liked what they're doing, it's probably not a bad place to put your vote. The NPA at the same time is also running 5 candidates, including several who'd run before or been on council before. Fraser Ballantyne has been elected in 2011 and 2014, and Christopher Richardson was elected in 2014 and was also a past Parks Board member. But other than that, NPA is actually drawing in some new blood, which is probably a smart call to avoid some of that acrimony. They have Lisa Dominato, who was a former chief of staff to the Deputy Premier and Ministry of Education, so someone with some deep BC Liberal ties. They have Jorge Julian Prieto, who's worked on a number of campaigns, apparently has a master's in science in math from Oxford and some other teaching experience. He's quadrilingual. He speaks English, Mandarin, French, and Spanish, so well-rounded. They have Rob McDowell, who ran in 2014 and is, I guess, a past diplomat, supports arts and culture, and works in the nonprofit. The only one that, and I'm pulling most of this out of Patty Baucus's article on all of the candidates running in the National Observer, or in the Vancouver Observer, with the caveat being that Patty Baucus was a former Vision Vancouver school board trustee and chair, so she's got an obvious bias in there. She did point out that Fraser Ballantyne was known for having quite a temper and once shouted shut up at a council meeting to someone else. So, you know, maybe you need some fire at your school boards, but after they came off a whole bunch of harassment allegations, I'm not saying don't vote for Fraser Ballantyne, I'm just saying know what you're getting. One city is running two candidates, which might be a bit bold considering their brand new party and trying to get some names out there, but they're putting up Carrie Berkic, B-E-R-C-I-C, someone who's been on parent advisory councils from 1998 to 2014 and has been involved in a number of other sort of Save Public Education advocacy groups, and also Erica Jaff, who has also been on PACs and is a data manager at the HIV Trials Network, according to LinkedIn. I couldn't find much out from them, but I'm sure if you go to One City's website, there'll be a bit more. The Greens, like I said, had Janet Fraser on the previous board, and she's running again. She's a PhD in chemistry, which I thought was pretty cool. Other than that, they're running two other candidates who are a bit more in, I guess, the stereotypical Green realm. They have Estreleta Gonzalez, who on Facebook also goes by SD Queen of Living Clean, who's a health and wellness consultant who's really big on detox, and she helped found the Dermabrite Clinic. So she's all about clean living. And then there's Judy Zykowski, who has a master's in consumer studies, and couldn't find much else about her. But running three candidates is a bit bold for the Greens. They might risk their one seat to try to go for three, but why not reach, I guess. COPE is running just one candidate, Diana Day, who's from the Oneida, I believe it's pronounced, First Nations, which is out in Ontario, I believe, with the sort of Iroquois Confederacy. And she served on district PACs as well in the executive, so sort of some experience with the education system. And then Jamie Lee Hamilton with the Independent Democratic Electors Alliance, which is the party of one, who's run for Parks Board in 2008, 2011, and 2014, and also City Council in 2005 under that, is running for school board now. And Patty Baucus commented, I didn't know she was interested in school board stuff, but there she is. Georgia Strait has called her a well-known political gadfly. She's generally seen as, or has done a lot of activism in sex worker rights and some of that stuff that's been a bit controversial, but I think I've come across her a couple times and she's interesting. And it's interesting to see her stepping forward for Vancouver School Board when there's a council by-election up, but I guess she's tried that and tried Parks Board, so why not try the school board? I guess the interesting thing is just seeing how the main parties are sort of choosing how many candidates and how many rerunning candidates they're putting forward, or how much fresh blood they're trying to bring in. And it seems like Vision and NPA are taking slightly different tacks. Maybe NPA's past councillors or trustees didn't want to run again, in which case they had to bring in new blood. And it's kind of hard to say no to someone who's been on council, say, since 1998. He gets it unless you have a massive member revolt. But then One City and the Greens are both being ambitious, perhaps, with the number of candidates they're running.
And finally, the last bit of Vancouver election news is we got our first hints at the 2018 election with former Conservative MP Mai Young, famous for the Stephen Harper is basically Jesus moment from the last election. She's announced that she'd be perhaps interested in the NPA nomination for mayor.
Yeah, she's hosting some kind of kickoff event on September 19th and inviting people to that. The Jesus comments are not going to like go away, I don't think, considering how small municipal politics can be. And given the sort of diversity and irreligion of Vancouver as a whole, I think that's going to kind of limit her appeal. We can't have a religious or a mayor who is religious, but in a... if you're the kind who like goes and brags about the prime minister being Jesus, or at least on the level of, or doing Jesus's work, it makes people uncomfortable, I think. But maybe there's the secret evangelical vote within Vancouver that she can get to turn out for her. Well, moving into quick takes. First up, the Massey Bridge. Well, it wasn't actually the Massey Bridge, it was the bridge to replace the Massey Tunnel, is on pause. The BC NDP has announced that the mega 10 bridge project that Christy Clark was really championing is not going to be going forward at the moment, and it's going to go to a technical review to try to look at, is this really what we need in terms of traffic flow and seismic considerations, and especially comparing it to like other projects that might need to be repaired, like the Patello Bridge that it's probably going to fall down with like a strong gust of wind.
Yeah, so what they've done is they've basically put the thing on hold, pending the review, and they've canceled the current tenders out there. So that does mean they're going to have to pay out, I think it's $2 million to each of the three shortlisted companies for this one. And should the decision be made following the review, that's expected to be happening sometime in the spring, there it's going to go out for a new tender. We're basically going to have to start the process all over again.
It sounds like a lot of money, but the estimated cost of the bridge was $3.5 billion, although it might have been as high as $12 billion, depending on what sort of leaks you believe in. So
the $6 million paid out to the that's not so much of a big deal. It's
and it's less than they're going to have to pay Gordon Wilson.
They've already paid out to do some of the other work on it. There's a little concern there, but you know, it's if you're spending $3.5 billion, you do kind of want to make sure you do it right.
And this is a project that every mayor in Metro Vancouver, except I think Delta.
Delta really likes the bridge.
Yeah, but no one else does because there are other projects and 10 lanes was never...
It was excessive compared to... It was a much bigger scaling up from the current four that are on that crossing. And you know, there's a decent argument to be made that, you know, four isn't sufficient and, you know, the tunnel definitely needs to be replaced because it is not seismically suitable anymore.
Although I know Patrick from Podkeep Our Land, who I had on the live show, and he hinted at it last week, has some very strong opinions on the bridge, but we didn't get to them in the live show. And I feel like at some point, if he doesn't do it on his show, we need to have him to just like hear his vent. I don't know if I'll agree with it or disagree, but it sounds like he's got strong enough opinions to merit a full vent. Or if you're listening, Pat, put it on your show and we'll just plug it next time.
Yeah, so there needs to be something done at that crossing. What is going to be still up in the air, and I think there's a pretty good case that 10 lanes is just way too big, and all it will do is end up with a congested 10-lane bridge and a hugely built-out delta. And much more effective, I think, would be something on the order of 6 to 8 lanes, including a dedicated rapid transit lane.
The other big issue right now, too, is since the NDP got rid of tolls on two of the big newer bridges in the lower mainland.
We now have no tolls on any bridge in the lower mainland.
One of the things that would have paid for this bridge would have been tolls. And now they couldn't just bring in a new bridge and put tolls on it because that would be ridiculous. It would make no sense and it would just upset those people even more. So now they didn't even have a way to pay for this bridge.
Yeah, and the same thing also applies to the Patello Bridge replacement, which was also going to be paid for tolls and also really needs to be upgraded because it's not up to current seismic standards.
It's also a death trap.
Oh yeah, I hate driving on that thing. Yeah. Both of those need to be upgraded. Like, they just don't meet modern safety standards, and we'll need to figure out something, but you know, I don't think it's the worst idea to put the thing on pause while it gets reevaluated. But I do kind of question Andrew Weaver's position of just put a second tunnel right beside it and twin the thing, which, okay, you may be slightly less disruptive and cheaper, but you still are left with 4 lanes of seismically unsound highway there, which doesn't really solve the problem. So the BC Liberal leadership race has just barely gotten underway, and we already have one big idea for it, and by big I mean mountain size, because BC Liberal MLA Lori Thronis put out a list of 65 proposals for a new liberal leader, and the highlight of that is the second one under tourism, shape a mountain to create a globally significant structure and fund that through the sale of the stone removed. So basically, there should be a BC Mount Rushmore.
Well, and he also wants to take the stone that's removed and build more structures across the province. I also don't know how much stone sells for, but I can't imagine it's enough to fund a major geo-sculptural thing. We tried to put out on Twitter, you know, who would you want to see on BC's Mount Rushmore? I think Kim Campbell was the winning vote.
One suggestion.
Vote. Yeah. There might have been another suggestion or two, but this is the idea that if it wasn't in there, almost no one would have paid attention to. There are some other gems in there that we should get into, but...
But it definitely got a lot of attention because of the Mount Rushmore, which never seemed like that great an idea. Like, just put in a face on the side of a mountain, but it does bring up an interesting question of who would you want to have a giant mountain-sized statue of?
And to be fair, he doesn't say it has to be a face. It's a globally significant structure, which could be literally anything. So it could be like a carving of the earth or who knows what. Still, quite the most bizarre, and in terms of like, you know, free market party ideas, doesn't quite fit in what I typically expect to come out of the BC Liberals. Like, there was lots in there that is straight up liberal stuff, like more private healthcare options, more money for independent schools, all that kind of jazz. Even some kind of liberal stuff, like be against proportional representation and backroom MLA dealing, even abolishing the corporate tax entirely and just paying for that with increased economic and job growth. But yeah, shaping mountains is some bold, bold ideas. The other ones I liked in there is that he wants to sell 1% of BC's crown land to people, whoever will buy it, in a fair way, though, he suggests, and just use that money from almost 1 million hectares of land. But he tries to emphasize that 93% of BC is crown land, and so he's going to use that money to just straight pay down the debt. I'm always a little wary of asset sales as a government, especially if it's just purely to pay off deficits or debts. It's not a very good long-term fiscal strategy. He also would apparently keep medical assistance in dying out of palliative care as per World Health Organization policy, which I guess would just go in complete violation of the Supreme Court of Canada, which has declared that medical assistance in dying is legal. He talks about the climate changing, and he says we can't stop that. So we should emphasize adaptation and pollution reduction over attempts to change global climate change. But then in a later line, he also talks about using desalination through renewable energy to just spread brine over wide ocean areas, I guess to just change the salinity and the salt content to counteract the effects of global warming. So he just has like this large-scale geoengineering project, which I'm sure would have no negative consequences.
The salt one's such a weird one, though, because usually it's like iron and is the typical ocean seeding approach. If anything, you'd expect increasing the salinity would probably hurt the ocean plant life, which would actually make it harder to absorb CO2. We'll let one of our biologist listeners fill us in on that one. But yeah, between that, and he's also a really big fan of compressed natural gas, to the point where he wants to build out a network of CNG facilities within BC to provide fueling for people's natural gas cars.
But people don't have natural gas cars, so he needs to encourage them to. But instead of just doing simple, you know, rebates on your conversion kits or whatever, a tax deduction, he's going to have the BC Lottery Commission run weekly conversion lotteries. Like, you win a CNG car, you win a CNG car. It's just so random. Even in his sort of like other section, he talks about really wanting to make it easier for people to represent themselves in the law system rather than fund lawyers through legal aid and, you know, help judges be welcoming of those self-representing litigants who I'm sure our lawyer listeners have some great stories about.
But yeah, all in all, just a interesting list, I think is probably the best way to put it. Somehow I don't see a huge amount of these getting a lot of traction in the liberal leadership race, and I'm going to guess the giant mountain-sized sculptures probably go in nowhere.
Whichever BC liberal leadership candidate endorses giant mountain sculpture will probably be the one who gets the Politicoast endorsement.
Yeah, and our friend from Parti Berlin, yeah, Matthew Naylor, who is a big fan of statuary, will probably also potentially be endorsing that.
Well, moving on to other inevitably ridiculous policies, the Ontario government has announced how it's going to handle the distribution and sale of cannabis in the province, and its plan is to do it entirely through the LCBO.
Except not the LCBO. It's basically copy the LCBO.
Well, it's going to let... So it's going to be that the LCBO gets to open new stores under a new brand. And it's going to get to open 40 by July 1st of next year, which will ramp up to 150 stores by 2020. And there will also be a government-run website where you can, I guess, get weed in the mail.
Yeah, so basically, Ontario, you get all the inconvenience of the LCBO with the added duplication of running the second set of stores.
It will also mean the hundreds of dispensaries that are around the province will be forced to close. They're also going to make sure that all of their product comes from the very small number of medical marijuana producers that have been licensed by Health Canada. And I think one of the big issues I've heard of our current regime is there aren't very many, like there's only 32 in Ontario, and more importantly, they're not very good. I don't know personally, but it's what I've heard. In terms of the rules, you'll only people 19 plus can buy or possess them, which is consistent with alcohol. It's not the 25 that I think a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists would prefer based on some of the evidence, but it kind of seems like it's going to be really hard to put it that high. They're going to say you can only consume it at home, like no smoking in public places, in parks, workplaces, or vehicles.
So basically the same rule as alcohol?
It's not clear if there will be like private clubs where you can smoke it or dispensaries. It sounds like it's a...
Much, yeah.
Buy your weed at the weed store. The government weed store will be like the beer store. And then take it home.
Except the beer store is a...
It's a conglomerate.
Yeah, it's a state-granted monopoly to a bunch of breweries. It's really weird. But the one thing I'm curious about is how the Ontario PCs are going to go at this. Are they going to tap the attack on independent businesses of forcing the dispensaries to close? Or are they going to go after it for letting weed into the hands of kids?
The initial complaints I've seen them have are trying to walk both those lines. They're like, they don't want to let it be an unsafe product. And if anything, I kind of think that this is the model that'll get the least into the hands of kids because it's so annoying. And if there's one thing the LCBO does do, like the government liquor stores in BC don't sell to minors because they'll be very strict about ID checks versus private business can sometimes be a little bit more lax until you clamp down on fines. What'll be interesting to see is what BC starts to do, because we'll have to do the same kind of road. It'll also be interesting to see if the federal government actually gets its laws in place by July 1st, as they've promised, because if not, this will kind of all be for naught.
Yeah, so far, I don't think it's made a huge amount of people happy. I've heard a lot of complaints, and for those who've never lived in Ontario, the LCBO is a source of fairly constant irritation for a lot of people, so... And I think there was a lot of hope that Ontario would not follow that model. But, yeah, seems like they're intent on doing it. But, yeah, that's the Wynne government for you. Well, it's like the drama from the Conservative Party leadership race is entirely over, as Brad Tross just filed a lawsuit against the Conservative Party over the issue of the leaked membership list, specifically filed in Ontario court asking for the judge to compel the party to give back the $50,000 fine they levied against him for leaking the list. So, for those who don't remember, the National Firearms Association got a copy of the Conservative Party membership list, and specifically the one that was given to the Brad Frost campaign, because what they did is they put a bunch of fake names in the list they gave out and were able to tell which copy it was based on the fake names that got mailings from them.
So Trost is upset because, in his words, the party essentially spoke to the media and sort of announced that they were going after his campaign before they actually told him they were investigating. So he kind of feels like he was thrown under the bus and not given a fair sort of hearing or chance to defend himself within the party. So he's asking not to say, you know, I didn't do this, but at least to be given the chance to say he didn't do it. Or at least his campaign wasn't aware of it or was done without his permission or knowledge. I have no clue how strong his case is. It seems like this is a pretty, with the seating that was done, it's pretty hard for him to refute unless
though he it's a they
totally
are,
rogue agent.
Yeah, well, the theory the Trost campaign has been floating is that someone in the party headquarters with access to all 14 lists just happened to give the Trost one away. But I have to say, I think it's probably fairly unlikely, unless there's some like weird procedural fairness thing at work here. But you know, I don't see Brad Trost getting very far with this. And if anything, it will probably make him even less popular with the caucus and the rest of the party. And it's also noteworthy, he was one of the few MPs that ran for leader that didn't get a critic post.
He did place fourth in the leadership race, though, so it's not like you can say he's unpopular in the party. This is fourth of 14. So
yeah,
he's got some support, some surprisingly strong support.
Yeah, that he does have a certain amount of support, but it's very much concentrated in one wing of the party. And I think it was less that people like Brad Trost and more that they some people like the stuff he was saying.
Very quickly, I'm just going to squeeze this in. I saw that I almost missed it this afternoon and everything else that was happening. The BC Utilities Commission actually today released a report from Deloitte LLP that was part of the review of Site C of the dam and project there. And basically what it found was kind of really mixed messaging. So it looked at sort of three of the questions that the NDP was sort of looking at. And it did say it's right now on budget and on time, which for a project its size is phenomenally unbelievable. But it sort of highlights a bunch of like asterisks that like it could go off the rails even if the NDP doesn't kill the project, that, you know, costs could balloon pretty quickly. Things can just happen. It also points that the costs of terminating Site C are in the same ballpark. So it's now the like, do you keep going with something that's potentially going to be very expensive, or do you spend a whole bunch of money killing it?
Yeah, you definitely want to avoid the sunk cost fallacy, but when both options are equally expensive in terms of money that has to be spent in the future, it gets a lot trickier on that. But I haven't actually had a chance to read this yet, so.
So this is sort of an interim report before the full BC Utilities Commission report gets back to the government on September 20th. And this is just sort of an overall really rushed timeline to do a very comprehensive review of a very big and expensive project, which, to give you a sense of the scale, suspending it would cost $1.4 billion, or just killing it entirely would cost $1.2 billion. And then there's potentially extra fees on top of there and some inflation costs and other things. But this project is already at $4.5 billion of investments and will cost somewhere between $8.3 and $12.5 billion. So we're talking serious amounts of money and not really an easy solution. And this isn't even talking about the First Nations issues and the claims they're making about the effects it'll have on their land.
Or the questions of what's the business case and how much power demand's going to be going forward too. So there's a fair bit of uncertainty both on the costs and the benefit side of the equation.
So we'll definitely have to come back to that when there's more information and we've read a bit more. This is a 116-page report that was just released, so there's lots more data out there and lots more information to be figured out.
Yeah, at some point with one of the extra bits of content we'll be providing now that we've hit our next goal, we'll probably be discussing Site C in a little more detail and actually read the reports and not skim the articles as they're getting posted.
On the other thing we'll have to discuss at least this month urgently on extra content is an NDP leadership deep dive, which we should definitely do before the race, the voting actually starts next month. The reason I just want to bring it up quickly, though, to close out today's show is on Sunday, if you're listening to this tomorrow, which will be today when it gets published, Saturday, on Sunday, there'll be a debate here in Vancouver at York Theatre on Commercial Drive at 12 p.m. I'm going to try to make it to that in person, but my timing might not work out in the morning, so all four candidates will be there. The other two big pieces of news are this week are that the two leadership candidates who dropped out have announced their endorsements. Peter Julian, the BC MP, who was first pitching the free tuition and anti-pipeline position, sort of taking up the left, he threw his endorsement behind Jagmeet Singh, which I think was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. And maybe more importantly, Pat Rebel Gorilla Stogren has endorsed Charlie Angus. And I think Charlie Angus even announced that he retained Stogren to do some like independent advice on veterans affairs and military issues, which he has experience in those things. So let that inform your votes as it will if you're an NDP member. And if not, enjoy the show.
And that has been Politico's. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politico's Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicos. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.